Since 2004, the ACLU has been litigating under the Freedom of Information Act for documents concerning the abuse of prisoners held by the Department of Defense and CIA. The litigation has produced thousands of pages of government documents, including the Justice Department torture memos, the FBI emails that discuss the torture of prisoners at Guantanamo, and dozens of autopsy reports relating to the deaths of prisoners in Defense Department custody. But much is still being withheld. In an effort to fill in the gaps between what has been released and what is still being withheld, the ACLU launched a website that attempts to give a full account of the Bush administration's torture program. Called the Torture Report, this website brings together everything we now know from government documents, official investigations, press reports, photographs, witness statements, and testimonials into a single narrative, one that is updated regularly and subject to critical review and improvement as it unfolds. The Torture Report is a collaborative project that brings together expert contributors to offer comments and observations as new material appears. These contributors include former senior military interrogator Matthew Alexander, former military commissions counsel David Fracht, human rights attorney John Sifton, blogger Marcy Wheeler, attorneys from the ACLU, and others. These contributors' annotations will be viewable in line in the text. We also invite members of the public to contribute additional information and comments at the end of each chapter of the Torture Report. As new sections are added to the report, chapters already online will be edited, expanded, or amended to address or incorporate the most valuable suggestions and latest information. In the Torture Report's diary feature, report author Larry Seams shares information on new discoveries and guides readers through additions to the narrative. Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com is also an expert contributor to the Torture Report. He sat down with Larry to discuss why the report is an important tool in Americans' pursuit of accountability for torture.
So you were just saying that some of your readers are asking where the OPR report leaves us and sort of the quest for accountability.
Well, I think anyone who is interested in accountability knows that the options are between slim and none. And given Obama's obvious preference, which has, I think, become strengthened over the last several months, that there be no real investigations, criminal investigations on the part of the Justice Department, everybody who wants accountability has been looking for side routes into accountability. And one of the few potential options was this OPR report, which was an extraordinary document because it was a years-long investigation into the legality and ethical conduct of these lawyers and concluded that the legal conclusions were not just wrong, but so deliberately false and in bad faith that they actually rose to the level of ethical transgressions. And then suddenly the Justice Department intervenes with a senior career prosecutor who adopts most of the conclusions, but nonetheless protects the wrongdoers from accountability. And so to me, what it really illustrates is just how serious the political class is, the permanent class in Washington is, about shielding their own from accountability. And so it is an important step in undermining the quest for accountability. But if there's enough public pressure for it, I think that it'll be much more difficult for it to be shooed under the rug.
That's great. I mean, I think when you talk about accountability, in a citizenry, the accountability is the responsibility of every citizen. You know, I think that, you know, looking for somebody else to carry out the investigation, you know, that energy only comes if it's driven by the citizens who know something already. And I think, working on the torture report, I see my role as the role of an ordinary citizen trying to piece together the story for myself to sort of, a lot of the information is out there from documents, from the kind of work that you've been doing for years. I need to process it, put it together, decide for myself what happened. I mean, I think there's the facts and there's the frame, and we lose on the frame time and time again. You know, you had a great piece the other day about Cheney bragging, in effect, that he violated torture law, that he was a strong supporter of waterboarding. And, you know, one of the things that he said, they were really pressing him on the Obama administration's handling of Abdulmutallab. And Cheney said, you know, they were asking, should we have waterboarded the guy? Should we have subjected him to EIPs? And Cheney said, the professionals need to make that judgment. We've got people we had in our administration, I'm sure many of them are still there, they're career personnel, who are experts in that subject, and they're the ones you might turn over to somebody like Abdulmutallab to. Let them be the judge of whether or not he's prepared to cooperate and how they can best achieve his cooperation. I mean, what's clear from the record is that is absolutely not true. It wasn't the career professionals to whom people were turned over to. It was a small group of renegade people who the career interrogators disapproved of, thought were sounding alarms about from the beginning.
And the orders came from the top. It was not a use your discretion. It was use torture on these individuals. There was no discretion vested.
Exactly. And even when these guys, the psychologist interrogators, said stop torturing these guys, the CIA people were sent from Washington to the black sites to torture them some more. So they didn't even listen to these quote-unquote professionals in deciding whether or not the person was divulging information. These things are facts, and I think that it's really important that people engage with the facts. They have the facts. Then you can begin to change the frame.
Well, yeah, to me that's the critical point, because even 2 or 3 weeks ago, David Petraeus was asked on one of these Sunday morning talk shows whether, with regard to the high-level Taliban commanders who have recently been detained in Pakistan, whether he wishes they could be subject to so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And David Petraeus, the hero of the right, the most respected military man in the country across the political spectrum, really quite resoundingly said what he's been saying for years, which is that these techniques don't work, that they're unnecessary because real professional interrogators actually know how to interrogate better by not using them than with using them, and that most importantly, they're so counterproductive and dangerous to our national security because in the areas for which he's responsible, Iraq and now Afghanistan and Pakistan, there's nothing more dangerous to first the U.S. military there and then to the United States itself than the anti-American hatred that is generated by our use of torture. And so these narratives don't get affected by those facts. And you know, it's often presented as though the people who care about torture are civil liberties extremists like us or people who are on the far left fringe. And the reality is it's really the entire establishment of the military and intelligence professionals who are most vigorously opposed to these techniques, and there was this sort of fringe rogue element within the government led by Dick Cheney really responsible for its implementation. And you know, I think the point that you alluded to is the critical one as well, which is we ought to have a system of justice where crimes get prosecuted without regard to the identity of the criminal, independent of what the public believes. That's what the rule of law means. But we don't have that system, and we haven't really had that system since Watergate, when we've decided that political considerations like the need to have political harmony and to move forward and not look backwards and all these cliches that got invented to justify pardoning Richard Nixon and then through Iran-Contra have now become standard political premises, which is that people in high political office should not be accountable when they commit crimes. And that's where I think the responsibility of the citizenry then is triggered to say, this is not acceptable to us, to have this two-tiered system of justice. And I think of any project that enables people to start interacting with the facts of what happened, to make it their own, to invest them in the issue, is really necessary to change that.
Well, and I think what's really interesting for me is that, you know, I think your description of this was a rogue group of people is absolutely accurate. I mean, I the more I read, the more convinced I am that this was a pattern that was connected to the DNA of this specific administration, and that you could take an almost random sample of Americans and put them in those positions, and we would not have arrived in these places because the values that they violated are so deeply entrenched. And, you know, a lot of the documents that the ACLU has pulled up are, you know, full of incidents in which ordinary American soldiers, ordinary interrogators, ordinary lawyers, you know, react to these things, see these things happening, and are outraged by them, are deeply offended by them, you know. And so one of the great things about digging down into the story is that you find it's not just the depressing story that you hear in the news where it's kind of off-putting, where how did this get to this point, and I don't even want to think about how we could have so betrayed our values. You find characters that you can identify with through the whole story. That was really interesting what you said about Petraeus, because it reminded me of John Yoo's op-ed in the Wall Street Journal the other day, in which he ends by, again, defending his broad interpretation of presidential power by giving this, you know, situation in Afghanistan where U.S. troops come across some goat herders. They know that as soon as they let them go, they're going to tell the Taliban and they're going to be attacked. and the field commander was so worried about human rights law and the international media that he lets them go, and indeed they're attacked. You know, and it sort of reminds you of the quote from John Yoo in the OPR report, where they ask him about the limits of presidential power, and he says, they ask him, well, would a president be entitled to massacre a village of civilians? And he says, sure. You know, I mean, these are absolutely extreme views.
Right.
You know, these are way out there. These are not mainstream American views, and I think Americans should engage with them and object to them.
But I think, you know, I think one of the problems is that these views were once fringe views, and they've become certainly more mainstreamed.
Do you think so?
By that, I don't mean that Americans now accept the fact that the president ought to be able to massacre villages, or even John Yoo was famously asked 2 years ago whether his broad view of presidential powers, his limitless view of presidential powers, would empower the president to order the testicles of a detainee
right.
to be crushed right. if he thought that it would generate important intelligence information, and he said it depends, meaning there may be circumstances when it would.
Right.
But I think the problem is that, and it really underscores the true importance of accountability. Accountability is not important because these are bad people who need to be punished, because in some sense of abstract justice, that's the right thing to do, or because it'll make us feel fulfilled to see evil people who did evil things pay a price. Those are important things. But the real importance of accountability is that if you don't have accountability, then what it means is that there's no reason for current or future people in political power to refrain from this conduct, because it means that there's no price to pay. And I think more importantly, what it has done, what the real danger of having the Obama administration not just walk away from this, but actively protect it by intervening in cases with the state secret argument and the like, is that it leaves the architecture in place. So yes, Obama has signed an executive order ordering that there be no techniques outside of the Army Field Manual used for interrogation, but there's no real structural impediments or even political impediments to their re-implementation, either by Obama or by some future. And there's been no adjudication of their illegality. And that's where I think the people who are opposed to torture, there's lots of people who are opposed to torture who have bought into the idea that, well, perhaps this is the kind of thing that we just need to let go because it would be too politically divisive, or because there's too many important things to do, or would it weaken Obama politically. That's where I think that those people who believe in that torture is so wrong and dangerous need to be engaged on the accountability ground, which is to say that it's not just about what happens in the past and what happened in the past. It's about who we are going into the future, and whether or not we have a real means to prevent it from reoccurring.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's interesting because it's not as though the accountability process has come to a halt, say, with the end of the OPR investigation. I mean, the courts, there are numerous cases in courts in this country and other countries that are just churning forward. And, you know, week by week and month by month now, there are decisions mm-hmm. in these cases which, you know, which document torture, which, you know, habeas cases in which people are being released because of, you know, the evidence against them was obtained by torture. Secret documents are being compelled to be released. The record is growing, you know. So that level of accountability, which again is just the kind of essential truth telling, is happening. I think it'll go forward. I think the story will be known eventually, you know. But there is, you know, it is going from facts to frame to, you know, really attacking the bigger structures in people's heads, where there's this idea where, you know, somehow the security requires you to bend some rules, you know. And I think that's, you know, that you're absolutely right. That's the one you have to go at, because these are not decisions about the past. It is decisions about how we treat people going forward.
Right. Well, one of the interesting things to me about the torture report from the beginning, the reason why one of the principal values that I see in it, is that I think you're absolutely right that if you were to show most Americans what actually happened and what was done as part of this regime, that they would be disgusted and horrified and ashamed that they're associated with it in any way. The problem is that most Americans don't actually know what was done as part of this. They know that there were extreme acts in Abu Ghraib and the like that they've been told were aberrations or the work of rogue low-level members of the military. And the only thing else that they know about what was authorized and the way it's constantly presented in the media, and I know when I talk to journalists about it, this is what they think as well, which is, well, when we talk about the torture regime that was actually authorized, what we're talking about is essentially three extremely dangerous high-level Al-Qaeda operatives who were waterboarded for a little bit. And then we got information from them, and that's essentially what the controversy was about. Maybe a couple people got slapped and treated a little bit poorly, but the level of the brutality and how pervasive it was, the fact that there are scores of people in our custody who died as a result of the treatment to which they were subjected during interrogation, the fact that the techniques that we use well beyond waterboarding were the hallmark of the Khmer Rouge and of Joseph Stalin and of the Inquisition. You know, as much talk as there has been about torture, I think there is a real scarcity of facts, and that has been a major reason for the disconnect that you're talking about between how the public thinks about these things and how they've been reacting. And any project that brings those facts to light, I think, is still incredibly valuable.
Well, and it's not just bringing them to light, because they're being brought to light by so many people in so many, you know, so many different ways, through litigation, through reporting, you know, through the blogosphere. But it's really just trying to bring them together into some, you know, into just a story with a beginning, a middle, and end, with identifiable characters who are responsible for decisions. I think it's also really important when, you know, it's been so important for me to understand, to break through this idea that there was a small group of people with a particular set of information, and operating on that set of information, they made decisions that anybody in their position would make. This is what they want people to believe, right? They were uniquely responsible for these things. You trusted us. We were doing what we had to do to protect you. What's really clear when you read the story is that put most people in those positions and they would have made the opposite decisions on how to treat people. And their decisions that they made would have probably resulted in much more, would definitely have resulted in more effective policies and greater security for Americans. And so I think, you know, the facts are out there. Putting them together into some kind of coherent story is difficult. And then also, you know, coming to the next question, which is, you know, what do we do about it? How do we get past this kind of prevailing myth that these are, you know, arrows in the quiver that, you know, should remain in the quiver should we ever need them? You know, and this is sort of where we are right now. You know, you arrest the underwear bomber. You know, shouldn't we have this option? Why shouldn't we have this option?
Right.
Well, because it doesn't work. Let's start there. It's wildly immoral, according to any kind of, you know, evaluation of human conduct and ethics, and it's counterproductive. You know, these are it's very simple. You know, and there the facts are there again and again, but we still, I think, you know, you pointed out the other day that in a way the architects of this program feel more emboldened by the week. As the, you know, as the quest for accountability seems to become more and more difficult, so now they've become outright braggarts, essentially.
They're basically taunting and daring people to do something about it, and I think that's the challenge, is to rise to that bait and to say, you know, actually we are going to do something about it. And you know, I think the point that you're making is actually critical, because and polling has sometimes gone in the opposite direction over the past year or so, which is odd given that, you know, this very popular president who was popular at the beginning actually ran on a platform of ending these policies, of putting an end to the torture regime. And he had made, before he was president, a rather eloquent and forceful case against it. And he won, obviously. And so there was a public appetite for these arguments. But since he's become president, that has retreated, and you've seen polling moving in the opposite direction, where people are actually more in favor of these kinds of tactics in the abstract than before. And I think the reason for that is because there's a very simple dramatic story told, as you said, that can be told because even though it's false, because this all operated behind a wall of secrecy, which was these were the most evil of the evil. They had information about imminent plots that were about to kill large numbers of Americans. They refused to divulge this information under traditional tactics, and therefore our only choice was let Americans die or use the enhanced interrogation techniques that were safe and that we used quickly and got the information and saved lives. And so if those facts are permitted to remain unchallenged, and you're right, it's not just the facts, but the storyline, the narrative, then I think it is an uphill battle. And so putting, and you're right, there are facts out there, lots of facts have been emerged, but even for people who write about this regularly, I spend full time, it's my job, to follow them. When the facts are dispersed, and, you know, there's one 85-page single-space bureaucratic report that contains lots of facts, and others that have leaked out in a court case in London, and others that have, you know, seeped out in some briefings that were filed in the Ninth Circuit, it's very difficult, even for someone who follows this, to put it all together in a cohesive narrative. And I think creating that storyline, that competing storyline that's grounded in reality, is indispensable for combating these falsehoods and myths that are taking root.
Thanks for listening to this ACLU podcast. The Torture Report can be found at www.thetorturereport.org.